Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Luke Garrett. I'm counsel for plaintiff appellant Leslie Jack. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to begin by addressing plaintiff's arguments as they pertain to her claims against Union Pacific. First, the trial court erred when, inconsistent with the standard at summary judgment, it evaluated the reliability or credibility of evidence that remained in the record and accorded it no weight. And specifically, that evidence was Dr. Brodkin's opinions regarding the asbestos content and materials on Union Pacific premises. The error was compounded by the fact that the court did so on a basis that was not advanced by Union Pacific and without notice to plaintiff or any opportunity to respond. In addition, the trial court erred when it applied an incorrect legal standard on the issue of foreseeability on the harms of take-home asbestos exposure, and it further erred when it failed to give plaintiff the benefit of reasonable inferences from the evidence on that subject. Now, on the subject of Dr. Brodkin's opinions were competent evidence that Mr. Jack and his father were exposed to asbestos on Union Pacific premises. The disclosed basis of those opinions was adequate. The disclosed basis included Mr. Jack's observations of the materials in question. Dr. Brodkin noted Mr. Jack identified them as chalky and white. The disclosed basis further included the time period at issue, the use to which those materials were put, the way those materials were manipulated and handled, literature about asbestos use in the railroad industry, as well as the prevalence of asbestos disease among railroad workers, and finally, a survey regarding asbestos use in another large railroad. That basis is adequate under the case law. Plaintiffs have identified the Bolthuis v. Rexall Corp. Case, where the court said the disclosed basis, an expert need state the basis for his or her opinions, but not the underlying details or reasoning. And in that case, the disclosed basis there was simply a doctor observed cancerous tissue, and that was an adequate basis to opine on the cause of that cancer. And so the evidence here is, in fact, more robust than in the Bolthuis case. Now, Dr. Brodkin didn't observe the materials himself. However, that's not required for expert opinion, and he was relying on Mr. Jack's personal observations. The basis for Dr. Brodkin's opinions here were consistent with other case law addressing expert opinion on asbestos content. We identified the Ganot case and the Zimco case. And finally, I'll just note, it wasn't controversial. It's not truly a controversial issue. So we pointed out a defense expert also agreed with Dr. Brodkin's opinion, and Union Pacific didn't attack Dr. Brodkin or Dr. Brodkin's opinions on that point before the trial court. I'd like to address the Stevens v. Union Pacific Railroad case, at least briefly. It does bear some superficial resemblance to this case. As an initial matter, there's a Ninth Circuit case out of Idaho, I believe. That case did not address what the basis must be for an expert to opine on asbestos content. It's silent on that issue. It just doesn't speak to it. The decisive issue in that case was causation. And on that point, the court employed Idaho law, which conflicts materially with Washington law on that issue. In Stevens, under Idaho law, the court said that plaintiffs needed to show a substantial exposure for a substantial period. Well, Washington law has a lower threshold for causation, for sufficiency of causation evidence. For example, a plaintiff need not quantify the exposure, need not apportion fault.
It need not be quantified, it seems to me, unless I misunderstand it, the decedent visited his father at the Union Pacific premises only perhaps twice a year. Am I wrong about that?
No, I believe that's correct. It was
causation is not a reasonable inference from
under Washington
actual presence on UP's property.
Under Washington law, Your Honor, that is sufficient for the causation issue to go to the jury. And I would point out
even in the face of the other exposures later in life and in other ways.
There's no Washington case decided by a Washington appellate court that would hold that, Your Honor.
If I spent 10 minutes at this property 42 years ago, can I get to a jury?
Your Honor, at some point it would presumably go to de minimis, but I'd point out here
that... Well, that's what I'm asking. Why isn't this de minimis, given how long ago it had been and how very, very brief these encounters were, even if you credit that whatever was white and chalky was in fact asbestos?
Well, Your Honor, among other things, I believe the evidence was that this would have been amosite asbestos, which would have been more potent. In addition, I would point the court to, well, the overall exposure from Union Pacific is not related to the visits to the property itself, but also the take-home issue.
Well, that's analytically, that's separate, isn't it?
Well, I think the issue is whether Union Pacific's negligence was approximate cause of Mr. Jack's disease. And I don't think the court can carve out and say, well, this exposure wasn't enough by itself. This exposure wasn't enough by itself. I think the court, the finder of fact needs to look at that cumulatively, the fault from any one defendant. Otherwise, you know, you could have eight exposures, none of which are sufficient on themselves, but collectively they are.
So I have a question on the take-home exposure under Washington law, because Washington law, as you know, incorporates the component of duty within the foreseeability. And so the foreseeability of, it would seem to me, you need to be foreseeability of a particular substance and then into the family unit. And there is a long line of, it seems, potential speculation there to get from where you start to where Washington law requires you to end in order to have foreseeability. So I'd appreciate your analysis of that.
Well, Your Honor, for starters, Washington law, and I believe Union Pacific agrees, that it would employ a general field of danger test to the subject of foreseeability. And it's, you know, the mechanism need not be foreseen, the specific harm need not be foreseen. I think the Lee v. Willis case actually illustrates that pretty well. The mechanism of harm wasn't foreseen, the type of injury wasn't foreseen, the person who might be injured wasn't foreseen, but the court held it was still foreseeable that, you know, a person would be injured if they're, you know, it was enough that careless behavior around high voltage equipment was dangerous. And I think that I think that the Lockwood case is clear on that, or indicates as much. It's held that a danger to one class of persons can be inferred from known danger to a different class of persons. I think that's analogous to the inference that we seek here, that the dangers of take-home exposure from, you know, one set of substances are known to be hazardous. From that, you could infer that a different substance could be brought home on clothing and be dangerous. We hear asbestos. But no, I don't believe at all that Washington law supports the notion that you need to look at the particular hazard and the particular substance.
In your view, Washington law says if there is foreseeability of one substance, that it incorporates all potential hazardous substances.
No, Your Honor, that's not my argument.
What's the parameters then?
Well, to the extent that, I mean, it's hard for me to talk hypotheticals of what the outer boundary is, but the asbestos dust, to the extent that it's obvious it would cling to clothes, it would fall within that general field of danger. Again, the specific mechanism and injury need not be foreseen. I think that that's clear under Washington law. I would also point out that in this case, there's evidence that was not discussed in Hoyt. For example, in the record, there's evidence that there was a leading cancer authority had written an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1946 indicating that workers handling carcinogenic materials such as asbestos should have showers and special rooms for storing street clothes. Given reasonable inferences from the evidence, that would suggest that that would, in part, to endanger persons who might encounter that substance as it left the work site. That was not discussed in, for example, the Hoyt case.
Did that article specify that it was to protect others, or was it to protect the worker? Because the worker is closest to his or her own skin and clothing, So was it specifically arguing that there was a danger to others, or is that your inference?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record at summary judgment specifies in that instance.
No, I'm However, asking about the scientific article that you're talking about in 1946.
I don't believe the record here specifies. I don't actually know off the top of my head. I apologize. I know the record, which doesn't specify that, but I think that that is a reasonable inference. I'd point to, I think it's a California case, the Kesner case, that says that it didn't interpret that specific issue, but it interpreted Department of Labor guidelines. Whereas I think the court here said, well, that was just for the workers. But no, the California court said, well, it was reasonable to infer that that would be not just the workers, but others as well. And at summary judgment, plaintiff is entitled to the benefit of reasonable inferences from the evidence. Judge,
what would have alerted UP at that in 1955 that it was reasonably foreseeable to take the worker taking home his clothes?
Well, Your
Honor,
it was
a danger to the family members.
Well, Your Honor, it was known that asbestos was a hazardous substance. It was established at the time in newspapers, textbooks, government publications, medical journals, that toxic substances could leave the workplace on clothing and or in various mechanisms, including on clothing, and cause harm. It is a simple application of logic and common sense to that, that could also apply to asbestos. I would indicate again that 1946 Journal of the American Medical Association article, which addressed the need to change out of clothing before leaving the work site specific to asbestos.
I know there's a Washington case, and of course, like our court, that you have the unpublished and published in the Washington system, but there was an unpublished case in the Washington Court of Appeal a couple years back of Brandis versus brand insulation. And it talks, and you're probably familiar with that because I know you're quite familiar with these issues, but it talks about that a much later period, of course, but it links the liability to the fact that the studies at the time linked the diffusion to family members, not, so you're like one click back from that, it seems to me, at a minimum. Why isn't that analysis that they employed there similar to what we should look at here?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that they said that anything less would have been inadequate. I don't necessarily remember the precise details of that, but I would indicate that, again, the general field of danger test that everyone agrees applies doesn't look to the specific product, doesn't look to the specific harm. It's application of logic and common sense. As I indicated, the Kesner court looked at some of these and said it's fair to interpret that that would also impose a danger on others in the workplace. I would like to call attention, I think Judge McKeown, you were talking about the series of inferences. I'd like to just call the court's attention to the Allen case decided by the Washington Court of Appeals. It's that case, the evidence of exposure and causation consisted of three sales records in three consecutive years for large amounts of asbestos cloth. From that, the Washington Court of Appeals held that they could infer, first of all, that that cloth had even been used in the shipyard in the first instance. Second of all, that the father who worked somewhere in the shipyard would have encountered the asbestos from that product. Further inferred that he would have brought it home, further inferred that his son would have been exposed, and further inferred that that is sufficient to cause the son's lung cancer, which incidentally requires significantly more asbestos than a mesothelioma. And that was sufficient causation evidence in that case. That may very well be the outer bound, but I think on causation, we're well inside of that. I'm happy to address further Union Pacific issues, but I'd like to turn to the Ford and DECO arguments before I'm out of time. With respect to Ford and DECO, on Ms. Jack's negligence claims, 5 of 9 jurors would have found for Ms. Jack. Nevertheless, the trial court decided that no reasonable juror could reach such a conclusion. That was error. The Washington Supreme Court in Lockwood explained...
Let me ask you quickly, if I've misunderstood your theory. As I understand it, your theory really is that Ford and DECO... should have warned the decedent so that he would take precautions at a different location at the Naval Shipyard. And is there evidence that the decedent knew that asbestos was present at the Naval Shipyard?
Your Honor, I believe Mr. Jack testified that he was not aware that asbestos was at the shipyard.
Well,
I think
let me
it is
ask you about the logic of that then. Suppose mm-hmm. they had warned him and said, you know, assuming that you have a duty to warn somebody about somebody else's location in the first place, which I have some question about also, but suppose they'd said, now be careful if you ever go to work with asbestos again, you know, because you've been exposed to it with us. If he didn't even know, then what possible causation is there?
Well, Your Honor, two points here, well, or several points. The first being that if Ford had gone, or DECO had gone to Mr. Jack and said, you've used our products, you may very well have been exposed to asbestos, asbestos may kill you, it's very important you avoid future exposures. With Mr. Jack's indication that he wanted to take precautions, he wanted to protect himself, it's a reasonable inference that he would have inquired into asbestos and learned about it. But second of all, once a continuing duty to warn applies, well, let me just say this.
So where is there a duty? This is what bothers me. Where is there a duty to warn about other people? And if you have a dangerous product in your own workplace or you've supplied it to someone, I understand that there's a duty to say, or potentially, there's a problem with this. But do you have to then go through a laundry list of other people? Or,
so,
you know, that
Your
just
Honor,
seems
the
very odd to me.
The duty is not to warn of all products and all persons, that sort of thing. The duty is that the manufacturers must conduct themselves reasonably. The duty is explained in the Washington Supreme Court's case in Lockwood, where they said, if the danger from a product continues after direct exposure, there's a duty of reasonable care to warn if that warning could reduce or lessen the harm. In that case, an asbestos manufacturer, the court held, an asbestos manufacturer may have a duty to warn about not, you know, that the people exposed to their products shouldn't smoke. And frankly, that is a farther step away from warning about further asbestos exposures because it is an entirely different product. The court characterized it not as warning about someone else's products, but giving a warning so that you can take precautions to avoid, to prevent manifestation of the harm from the defendant's products. If you smoke, it's more likely to get lung cancer or asbestosis. If you get further asbestos exposure, you're more likely to develop the mesothelioma, which is the underlying risk from the exposure in the first place. I think that's it. I mean, the trial court found issues with respect to the reasonableness and causation, but with respect to the actual duty, I think it's very clear under Washington law, and that the warning about further asbestos exposures is well within the Lockwood case, which says that they had an obligation to warn about smoking. On the issue of causation, I would just say this. There was evidence in the record, about a variety of precautions, and some of them are quite simple. Dusting yourself off before you leave the workplace where there's asbestos, showering, changing clothes, even just trying to avoid dust in addition to respiratory protection. Under Washington law, causation may be established if the negligence of a defendant contributed to some portion of the injurious exposure. Again, it's not necessary to quantify. It's not necessary to apportion fault. A jury could have looked at that and said,
You're down to a little over a minute. Did you want to save that for rebuttal?
I would. I'll just say that a jury could look at if Mr. Jack had showered, if he dusted himself off, if he just tried to avoid dust, that would have reduced his injurious exposure and that is adequate under Washington law to sustain a verdict on causation. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You can do this in any order you wish, but on my list, Mr. Riley for Union Pacific would speak next.
Yes. Good morning. My name is Carl Riley with Cozen O'Connor, and I represent Union Pacific Railroad Company. Before I start, we want to say that our deepest sympathies for the particular loss in this matter. This court should affirm the district court's denial of the motion for reconsideration for two bases. First, no genuine issue of material fact existed that the Union Pacific property contained asbestos-containing products. Second, if there were any type of indication of asbestos on the property, no particular take-home exposure liability existed because no duty existed regarding any type of take-home liability. Before I get started on my points, I want to go over the particular review in this case. Because there is a denial of a motion consideration, this court reviews for abuse of discretion, not de novo. There is no genuine issue of material fact that the Union Pacific property lacked asbestos-containing materials. There's no evidence of large purchases of asbestos. That is very indicative in the Allen case, as was stated by appellant. There's no evidence of co-workers testifying as to the working conditions of the Union Pacific property. Further, there is no particular evidence of witnesses or anyone with the requisite foundation to testify that there were asbestos-containing products on the Union Pacific property. This is evidenced by Morgan v. Aurora and also the Lockwood case, where there has been objective evidence of asbestos on the property before the expert can opine as to any particular level of exposure. Appellant is unable to separate this case from any other Washington case that provides the existence of asbestos-containing products on the property. Now, appellant tries to distinguish Stevens from the incident matter, and we believe that he cannot do so. In Stevens, plaintiff provided the exact same testimony that is here, that the workplace was dusty, and that's particularly it, because that's all a layperson is able to testify, cannot provide expert testimony. In Stevens, there were two experts who particularly provide that there was substantial exposure, and that the father, the plaintiff's father, was exposed to, had substantial exposure to asbestos, but there is no, indifferent in Stevens, there was actually an admission by the particular railroad that there was asbestos on the property. Here, there's no evidence of any type of asbestos-containing products in on the particular site. That is the difference here. Even taking that difference, the Ninth Circuit held that this was insufficient to, the expert was insufficiently opining as to the particular exposures that occurred there. Specifically, the experts in Stevens provided that plaintiff had substantial exposures, but had no knowledge of the degree to which plaintiff's father was exposed to the asbestos work. Here, likewise, Dr. Brocken testified that he did not have any knowledge outside of what was provided by plaintiff as to what the roles of appellant's father was at Union Pacific. The Ninth Circuit held that this was particularly insufficient. Specifically, it said that although plaintiff testified that the work site was dusty on the plaintiff's visits there, that does that the courts evaluate and expert peer-reviewed opinions. Here in this case, there's no evidence of any of that. We have no prior instances of any type of take-home exposures that Union Pacific should have been aware of. No worker policies and no particular legislative indications that take-home exposure liability was evident as of, and what this is important here, 1955. We cannot look at it at the lens in 2021. We have to look at it in 1955. And that's very, very important here. Now, the difference between the articles that are cited by appellant and what was indicative of their own expert has said there is no peer-reviewed articles until 1960 is those particular instances and articles were really focused on the employer. We're not talking about taking the employee and coming home and exposing the family. This is I won't go into an example, but the asbestos at that point in time was really knowledgeable and known only in focusing on the employee.
It looks like the clock is back and that it's down to zero. So I think we likely to have
used 1 minute.
We have 1 minute?
No, you argue for your full 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you put 5 minutes on the clock for Mr. Burgess, I believe he'll be next.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brian Burgess for DECO Appellee. Following the
wait, 5 minutes, please.
Once again, the clock is freezing up. So I mean, I know you can see it, but I can't control it.
Oh, okay. Well, you will just rely on you to holler.
I'll use my cell
phone. holler when you're down to about a minute so Mr. Burgess can start to sum up.
Okay, will do.
Thank you, Your Honor. Following the jury verdict in this case, plaintiffs are no longer asserting that Victor Gaskets are themselves unreasonably dangerous or otherwise taking issue with the adequacy of the warning at the point of sale, suggesting that it had any effect on Mr. Jack. Instead, they're relying entirely on the unusual theory that if DECO and Ford had provided post-sale warnings to former customers like Mr. Jack, that somehow it might have led him to avoid exposure from other asbestos products at his workplace at the shipyard over a period of years. We've explained in our brief why we think that theory fails for several reasons. I'd like to focus today on one, and it was the theory or the issue Your Honor, Judge Graber identified. As the district court noted in this case, plaintiff's causation theory is inherently speculative. Mr. Jack testified, and I understand it from Mr. Garrett earlier to be undisputed, that Mr. Jack was unaware of the presence of any asbestos at the shipyard during his relevant exposure period. So there's simply no evidence in the record to suggest that he would have taken any measures if he had been given a standard warning about automotive gaskets because he didn't know about asbestos at the shipyard, much less what those measures would have been or whether they would have been successful. And again, I take much of that to be undisputed. They don't disagree that Mr. Jack didn't have that knowledge. They did not suggest in their briefing that a standard warning about automotive gaskets or even about the risks of asbestos generally could have had that effect. Instead, they're relying on an expansive and unprecedented theory of legal duty that a manufacturer would have the obligation to educate its former customers about asbestos risk in other products and other industrial settings. As we pointed out in our brief, they didn't develop that theory below, and I didn't see them in their reply brief to take issue with our waiver point on that. But even on the merits of it, it's legally baseless. Washington law is clear that a manufacturer generally has no duty to warn about asbestos in other companies' products. That's well-established Washington law. It's well-established common law, and it makes eminent sense. The idea of a duty to warn is that a manufacturer is in the best position to know about the risks that its product might create and to investigate and provide the resources to give an adequate warning. But there's no reason for an automotive manufacturer to have knowledge about where asbestos is likely to be found and where there's going to be a likely risk at a shipyard or many of the other places in the economy where asbestos could be found. I understand the other side in resisting that conclusion to rely pretty exclusively on Lockwood, but I just submit that Lockwood does not support their broad reading and the duty that they would create. The actual issue in Lockwood was simply, it was an evidentiary question about whether it was appropriate to admit evidence of danger risk that was acquired at post-sale, post-exposure. And the court held, yes, it was, because asbestos is unique in that there are latent risks, and so if the plaintiff could put on evidence that if he had been warned about it, he might have taken actions in his life to avoid that risk. But there was no indication in the opinion that the manufacturer was required to provide warnings about tobacco products generally. And even if you took on the idea that there might be some limited circumstances in which you could have a duty to warn because there's a synergistic risk created by use of your product and another product, if there was a record developed about that a manufacturer knew about that information, what plaintiffs are seeking here goes well beyond that, because there would require a manufacturer to know all the different sort of products and industrial circumstances in which asbestos might be found. And of course, for Mr. Jack, it involved a shipyard and asbestos.
Well, counsel, I think perhaps you're overstating their argument. As I understood it, the argument is that the warning should say, take care to find out in any future employment situation whether there's asbestos, because if so, you're at greater risk for having been exposed to ours. And they wouldn't really have to know anything about where you were going or what those locations were like.
I mean, I read their briefing differently to suggest that there is a duty to educate the circumstances.
Well, I read the briefing differently too, but I understood the oral argument today to be a slightly more subtle version, perhaps.
Sure. I guess in response to that, there was not that argument was not developed below. There's not an evidentiary record that Mr. Jack suggested that if he'd received such a warning that he would have taken those measures. And in fact, when he actually learned about asbestos at the shipyard in the mid-80s, the record is that he did not do any of the things plaintiffs suggested he might have done, whether wearing a respirator or a mask. He that was not part of the training. So to suggest that if he had learned this information from an automotive gasket manufacturer, he might have taken those measures just as pure speculation. And for that reason, we think the court needs to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. We're ready for 5 minutes on the clock, which happily seems to be working for Mr. Batalden. I hope I haven't mispronounced that.
No, that's correct. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. Petter Batalden, appearing on behalf of Ford Motor Company. Like DECO, which my friend Mr. Burgess has just advocated for, Ford also prevailed on the Jaymaul ruling issued by the district court. And as Judge Graber, your questions have probed, and as Mr. Burgess has said, there is simply no evidence in this record that Mr. Jack knew that there was any asbestos at the shipyard. And so it's unreasonable to infer that he could have taken any precautions had he wanted to. And I think I don't need to discuss that any further because Mr. Burgess had. I do want to talk about an additional reason that the district court identified to support its Rule 50B ruling. This is an independent reason to affirm the judgment for Ford. And that is that there's no evidence that any precautions Jack could have taken at the shipyard would have been effective. And it's one thing to talk, as Mr. Garrett has, about dusting oneself off, taking a shower, wearing a mask or a respirator. But it's another thing to show through expert scientific testimony that those precautions would have made a difference. And the record here is silent on that point. Plaintiffs introduced no expert evidence to show the precautions Jack could have taken at the shipyard would have been effective. The only evidence on that subject comes from Ford's expert, who properly noted that it was very uncertain, it was speculative, whether any precautions would have been effective. You know, if you're talking about, let's say, a respirator, you have to have it fit tested. It has to fit snugly, and you have to use a change-out cartridge program to get the benefits of filtering. If you're talking about another precaution, maybe it's a ventilation hood, it has to be placed in a location where it's adequately going to capture the exposure that Jack is receiving, rather than having it be placed in a different location where he's not working. And if you're on a ship where he sometimes worked, that's very difficult. So there simply is no evidence that any precautions Jack could have taken would have been effective. So between that and the fact that, as Mr. Burgess discussed, he didn't know there was asbestos at the shipyard, I think the overwhelming inference from this record, as the district court found, is that the plaintiffs failed to prove causation. There are simply too many evidentiary gaps in their effort to prove causation. I'd like to touch on two other points briefly before I conclude. Mr. Garrett began by noting that there were some jurors who had announced, apparently after the trial, how they would have voted had they been able to return a verdict on negligence. I'm not aware of any authority. I don't think Mr. Garrett has supplied any authority today or in his brief that is a permissible consideration in determining the impact of the product's liability verdict for Ford on the negligence claim. You know, if anything, that runs headlong into the spirit of Federal Rule of Evidence 606B, which forecloses inquiry into the mental processes of jurors. So I don't think that's an appropriate consideration for the court. I also want to touch on the question I think, Judge Graber, you asked. No, I'm sorry, it was a point Mr. Garrett made, that had Mr. even though Mr. Jack did not know about asbestos at the shipyard, it was reasonable to infer that because he wanted to take precautions, he would have inquired had he been given a warning. He would have made some further inquiry. And I want to make two points about that. First, that just contorts the burden of proof and places it on Ford, when in fact it's the plaintiff's burden to show causation. Ford doesn't have to disprove, which is in effect what you're saying, if Jack is required to inquire, having been given only the briefest hint of knowledge that there's asbestos. And second, that really doesn't make any sense to believe that he would have inquired had he been given a warning when the jury had already returned a verdict holding that Ford's products without warning were appropriately safe. And that, after all, was the product's liability verdict for Ford. Both on a design theory and on a failure to warn theory, the jury found that Ford's products were reasonably safe. Unless there are any further questions from the court.
Well, I just have a question about that, because the standard, the legal standard for demonstrating product's liability and the legal standard for demonstrating negligence are different. So I'm not sure that there's an equivalence of the kind you were just trying to draw, that the jury's verdict on one essentially forecloses a different verdict on the other.
Your Honor, what I would say about that is that the same causation instruction governed both claims in this case. There was a product's liability failure to warn claim.
But that's not what you said. You said it had to do with whether the product was sufficiently safe and whether a warning was required, and if so, what kind. And that's not the same as causation. That's why I asked the question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yeah, I think that this gets to the effort to reconcile the verdict, which is an alternative argument for affirmance that we made in the brief. This court is welcome to address that if it wants, but it can certainly affirm on the JML ruling that the district court gave. But just briefly, there are only two ways to construe the verdict in Ford's favor. One is that the product was reasonably safe. The other is that the plaintiffs failed to prove causation. And it can't be, you know, one way or the other. Ford has to prevail on negligence, because if the jury found no causation as to the product's liability claims, it couldn't have found causation as to negligence. They were both failure to warn claims under the same instruction.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Garrett, I believe you have a little bit of rebuttal time remaining. Wait a sec. Let's wait for the clock to go where it needs to go. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll begin by noting, as Ford even concedes in its briefing, the strict liability verdict does not establish that the product was reasonably safe at the time of sale. As we've pointed out, it could very well have been that the jury found that it failed on the proximate cause issue, which again is different. What must be a proximate cause is the product in a strict liability claim versus the negligence in a negligence claim. On the issue of causation, I'll note that I think it is the Morgan case where the testimony was that the overall shipyard exposure was the cause of an individual's disease, and that was sufficient to sustain a verdict for one manufacturer of one subset of the products. The sort of expert testimony that counsel for Ford is suggesting should be required just is not required under Washington law. It's enough that if a defendant is responsible for an injurious exposure. We're not appealing reconsideration. Union Pacific's arguments generally go to the weight of the evidence and should go to the jury. Expert opinion is evidence. And finally, counsel for Union Pacific does not dispute, or at least hasn't today, that the standard under Idaho and maritime law is materially different for causation than under Washington law. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case just argued is submitted, and we appreciate helpful arguments from all four of you. So with that submission, we're going to take about a 5-minute break before hearing the last case on this morning's docket.